I'm very pleased to welcome to Fremantle Shipping News, Richard Mackay. Welcome, Richard.
Thank you. Thank you.
Well, we're here in the 1907 Old Customs House in the west end of Fremantle. You must feel sort of at home amongst these old buildings.
Well, it's absolutely lovely to visit Fremantle again. It's a little while since I've been here, and on this visit I've had a bit more of a chance to enjoy the west end, walk most of the streets, and yes, it's fabulous to be, you know, amongst these historic structures that absolutely redolent with Fremantle's history.
The strange thing, which a lot of people don't realise, even the locals, is that Western Australia, and really more to the point, Fremantle, is not even 200 European years old. It's not quite there yet.
That's right. I think three more years until the bicentenary of the European arrival. Of course, a much longer ancient history with First Nations peoples, but you know, a place that's really engaging because of its interesting layers of history that, you know, now date back into antiquity, but in terms of European arrival for a couple of centuries.
It's phenomenal. And in many ways, I think West Australians are rediscovering their, so their indigenous as well as their European history at this point. Something like Juukan Gorge happened not long ago, and ancient material culture there, you probably were delving into it all when it happened.
Well, in fact, a little bit further back in 2016, I was part of the team that prepared the Commonwealth State of Environment report. And I used the Western Australian Indigenous heritage legislation as a case study back then of something that might not provide adequate protection for all aspects of Indigenous culture. So it was a bit sad that it came to pass with the terrible events at Juukan Gorge.
They were truly terrible. Now, I should just tell our listeners a bit more about you, now that I've sort of intrigued them a bit, Richard. You've got your own consultancy, Mackay Strategic, and I noticed on your website you're described as the founder and the quote-unquote director of possibilities. I love it.
Yeah, well, the backstory to that is that after about four decades in the heritage world, I formed a view that a lot of it is regulatory and tends to say to heritage place owners and managers, potential developers, what you can't do. And when I formed this practice about 10 years ago now, I was very determined to make it strategically focused, hence the name, Mackay Strategic, and also about helping people with what they could do, hence that self-titling of Director of Possibilities, which gets quite a lot of traction.
Well, it gets one to ask the question, doesn't it? And you've just answered it. Mm. Well, it's clear, as I think many people acknowledge, that you've got a certain dynamic leadership quality to you, been four decades in this game, if I can call it that for the moment. And it's not surprising. So listeners, this is part of the four decades. In 2003, Richard was appointed a member in the General Division of the Order of Australia for services to archaeology and cultural heritage, thus the AM that comes after his name, and congratulations. But that's 2003. It shows you he did a lot before 2003 to be awarded that. He's an adjunct professor in the Cultural Heritage and Museum Studies program at Deakin University in Melbourne, and before that, for a long time, adjunct professor in the archaeology program at La Trobe. He has served on ICOMOS, and many of you may have heard that, many more of you probably haven't. Its longer description is International Council on Monuments and Sites. It's an international body. And Richard has served as an expert advisor to the UNESCO World Heritage Committee since 2015, a good 10 years, an important and interesting job. And recognising all of that skill, in 2023, Richard was the convener of the ICOMOS Global General Assembly, which was hosted in Sydney. And not surprisingly, a member, an honorary member of ICOMOS as well. Richard was appointed to the Australian Heritage Council as one of two historic members in July 2024. And not that long ago, probably, what, about 10 or a dozen years ago, was the inaugural winner of the Australian Heritage Council Sharon Sullivan Award for his contribution to Australia's national heritage. So it really is appropriate to be able to welcome you to the historic West End, Richard. Before we go any further, though, what is an historic member of the Australian Heritage Council?
Well, yes, I was sort of wryly smiling as you said that. The Australian Heritage Council is a statutory body established under Commonwealth legislation to advise the Australian government on Australia's heritage, particularly the National Heritage List, but heritage more generally. And it's comprised of a chair who's appointed by the minister. That's currently the Honourable Bob Carr, former Premier of New South Wales. And then there are three pairs of members with particular skills and expertise. There's a pair who look after natural heritage, a pair that look after Indigenous heritage, and a pair that look after historic heritage. So it's always very amusing when I'm introduced as one of the historic members of the Australian Heritage Council. It makes me sound truly old.
So makes it sound like you're on the register yourself.
Indeed, yes. Highly significant.
The council, of course, was preceded by the Australian Heritage Commission, which followed the Hope Report, which brought down the bigger report way back in the day on the National Estate. And you were probably one way or the other around the circuit. How did you get in?
Not quite there at the beginning of all of that, but you're right. The Hope inquiry into the Register of the National Estate was an important trigger that caused progressively all of the Australian jurisdictions to have heritage legislation and the Commonwealth itself firstly establishing the Register of the National Estate and the Australian Heritage Commission, which has morphed through statutory change into the current arrangements under the Environment Protection Biodiversity Conservation Act with things like the National Heritage List. But then particularly during the second half of the 1970s, virtually all of the state and territory jurisdictions also followed with special heritage legislation, sometimes dealing in an integrated way, sometimes in a different way, with different categories of heritage.
The 70s was the environmental decade, and heritage got caught up in all of that. It's part of the environment, after all. I once taught environmental law at the law school at the ANU, and one of the first things I got them to do was go and read the Hope Report. It was a beautiful thing, beautifully written.
Yes, it's very eloquently written, and Robert Hope was himself very committed to heritage. He ended up becoming chair of the first State Heritage Council in New South Wales, and I was privileged to hear him speak about that time on the register on the National Estate Inquiry. And he spoke very eloquently of visits to farmsteads and understanding landscape and understanding the interplay between history and aesthetics. And I think his and his colleagues' understanding of the breadth of heritage provided a very important foundation for how we assess, understand and manage heritage today.
Well, a lot of people understand in a real sense the need to keep old things, and probably if they're living around Fremantle, the old things they think are valuable and worth keeping are the ones around us here in the West End, most of which are considered to be gold rush buildings, built about the time after Coolgardie and Kalgoorlie started producing wealth for the state. Hotels and customs houses and all sorts of things got built then. But heritage these days, nationally and internationally, as you're intimating, I think, is more than old buildings.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it's about places that we value and want to pass on to future generations. I mean, the word heritage is all about inheritance. And so there is this concept of intergenerational equity. And I think in mature administrations, as we have here in Australia, there's fairly well articulated criteria and mechanisms for assessing heritage places, natural and cultural. Many places, of course, have both natural and cultural values. And cultural values, people like to categorise them and divide them between Indigenous and historic, as we do in our institutions. But in fact, it all comes down to why places are important. And that can be historic. It can be because of their physical presence, their aesthetic or creative attributes. But it can also be because of their scientific research potential, or simply because people love them, and social significance is one area of that discipline which over recent decades has really come to the fore in terms of institutional understanding of places that are cherished and loved by the communities to whom they're important.
Are there any areas that are contested these days?
Just about everywhere. I mean, and this the contest happens for all sorts of reasons. So to start with, there can be contest between multiple narratives and values, and places that, you know, and somewhere like an early settlement or a landing place of European settlers, some would say European invaders, which is itself happening on country which already had values and associations for First Nations people. I mean, there's a conflict of itself. I mean, the Swan Brewery site in Perth, I think, was a classic example in the mid-1990s, where there were animated narratives between traditional custodians and those who valued the site for its, you know, post-colonial values associated with the brewery. And the reality is that places can have multiple narratives and multiple values. And places that can have rich histories may also have evolving physical manifestations. And, you know, we're sitting here quite close to the port, where there is a very dominant 1960s building, you know, that is from quite a different historical phase, quite a different design concept from any kind of prehistory, you know, let alone the sort of convict settlement or the Gold Rush and Federation development that has created the rich built environment today. So there you have something that sort of sits out alone as a piece of 20th century modern movement architecture. And it's also heritage listed.
And people love it. And barely 100 metres from it, going across the Swan River mouth, the Derbal Yerrigan, as it's known in Wadjuk language, is an old limestone bar.
Well, there was, except it got blown up to create the port.
And if you were doing that today, it would be a bit like the Duke and Gorge we referred to earlier, I suspect.
Well, indeed. And, I mean, interestingly, there is a remnant of that limestone bar that's sort of tucked in under the Maritime Museum. Sadly, when I saw it yesterday, saw it through some of the flotsam and jetsam rubbish. But, you know, there is, for example, an opportunity to use that remnant to tell the story, you know, of what was there before and its First Nations tradition and belief that attaches to that.
That's an interesting way to put it, because sometimes the awful exceptions remind everybody how exceptional it is and how bad what happened is as well. Mm. I've got an old TAB agency down on High Street that you probably walked past and learnt the story about, set back an absolute interruption in the West End history. So there are those places. What brings you to Fremantle right now?
I've been pleased to accept an invitation from the Fremantle Society to come and look at how heritage is identified, conserved and managed in the context of a requirement by the state government that Fremantle will have a new planning scheme. And the council itself, you know, is busy at the moment. It has a new plan for the city centre on public exhibition, and there's a new mayor, and there's, I guess, interest in saying, well, what might we do better or otherwise in terms of managing the city's heritage. And then along with that, I also have, as you very kindly mentioned, a background in World Heritage Place Management. So there's also a very interesting question here in Fremantle about the connection between the prison, you know, which is a component of an Australian World Heritage property, and how it relates physically, visually, historically, and operationally to the historic core of the West End and the broader heritage of the city. That's a long answer. The short reason I'm here is that I accepted an invitation to come and visit the place, understand it, and offer some commentary in view of my, I guess, experience and history in managing cultural heritage places in Australia and around the world.
I mean, you really have been around the world, and I would invite our listeners to go onto your Mackay Strategic website and have a look at the huge number of places you've gone, no doubt some with ICOMOS, some because you've been consulted. What's been the range of work that you've done?
Well, look, I've been very privileged over my career to work in some extraordinary places. In fact, I sometimes say to people that, particularly in my current role as an expert advisor on behalf of ICOMOS to the World Heritage Committee, I don't know anyone who has a job that I'd rather have at the moment. So over the course of time, my original training was in archaeology, and I've worked as a research officer and lobbyist with the National Trust in New South Wales, and was particularly well known there for running the campaign that saved the Woolloomooloo finger wolf, now one of the great conservation adaptation stories in Sydney. I then worked a lot as an archaeologist, and I was lucky enough to direct a major archaeological excavation in the Rocks Precinct in Sydney. It's known as the Big Dig, and it's now adapted as an archaeology education centre and youth hostel with the sort of convict period and later archaeological remains conserved. That led to a couple of decades in a consulting company now known as GML Heritage, and through that I worked all over the place. I was developing tourism management strategies for Angkor in Cambodia. I was lucky enough to give it strategic advice for the Papua New Guinea government in terms of their cultural heritage management. I've worked at Sydney's Luna Park, looking at that historic site for decades. And been fortunate to prepare heritage management plans for the Rocks and look at hundreds and hundreds of cultural heritage management sites. You know, in terms of the convict sites that are on the World Heritage List from Australia, I think there are 11, and I've been lucky enough to work at 9 of them. You know, and I facilitated management planning for both Port Arthur in Tasmania and Kingston and Arthur's Vale on Norfolk Island. It really is a very privileged existence where I get to engage with some amazing people. Most recently, I work in what's known as the State of Conservation. That is a little bit more challenging. So that is the World Heritage properties that are back before the World Heritage Committee because there's a perceived problem. And so the kind of things I've been dealing with there are the impacts of conflict in Syria, with the activities of Islamic State and the Levant. Serious damage to properties like Palmyra and Damascus and Aleppo, responding to the effects of earthquake damage in places like Bagan in Myanmar or Kathmandu in Nepal, but also questions of proposed development, infrastructure or urban projects. Over recent years, I've been very active in relation to proposals to put a tunnel through part of the Stonehenge landscape, or to build very large buildings in the historic centre of Vienna. So it's a very broad area of work, but the common theme is the outstanding universal value of these places for humanity. So I'm very privileged to work on them.
To try and convey to our listeners, those of whom, I don't think they'd be sceptical, but want to understand why it matters to keep these things that you're talking about. You can say Stonehenge, you wouldn't want it to crumble because a tunnel goes underneath it. And some might say, well, it's old. Does it really matter? What about the West End of Fremantle? Why do these things matter?
Well, heritage is ultimately an intangible attribute that comes about because of how we react to places. And heritage places underpin cultural identity. They contribute to sense of place, to people's understanding of themselves, where they've come from, but also to the quality of the environment in which they live. And of course, a lot of people have attachments to places because of what has happened there, either to them or to their forebears or to the cultural context from which they come. So, heritage is all about the places that we value not just because of their economic value, but for other reasons that they are important to us as individuals, as communities, and that we want to and they're places that we therefore want to look after and ensure that others have the benefit of enjoying them as well.
Richard, I made a podcast with Moshe Rosenzweig, who runs the Head On Photo Festival, both in Sydney and it's on now in Perth. And I was asking him about photography and whether it had some sort of heyday. Is it as popular today? And he said the heyday was the 70s and 80s. A little bit less support from official organisations these days was the message I took away. Is heritage a victim of cyclical thought in this regard? The authorities, the state, the federal, the local, as keen on heritage as they once were?
It's definitely cyclical, but also that's partly because it has become institutionalised and acceptable. So in the 1970s, 80s, as my career was beginning, heritage was something that community groups literally had to fight for and man the barricades. You know, there were protests in the Rocks, in Sydney, in Woolloomooloo, here in the West End, where communities actually got out and made their views known to development interests and to government. Now, arising from the process, you know, of the inquiry into the National Estate and into more general evolution of planning and environmental legislation around the country, the concept of heritage has become institutionalised. So we do have heritage schedules, conservation areas, places that are on state and national registers, they are in lists and they're regulated. Now, because that corpus of places is protected, you don't need the same level of community activism. So yes, of course the community activism drops off, but the interest is there. It becomes reflected in exhibitions or publications, research and events. And of course the other thing that happens is that when a cherished place becomes threatened, then from time to time the community will mobilise. And you see things like the membership of the National Trust will ebb and flow depending on how much agitation is happening with development interests or threats through resource extraction or action or inaction from, you know, our elected or appointed government officials.
Right around the country for a few decades now, I was once the chairman of the WA Town Planning Appeals Tribunal, and another time the president of the State Administrative Tribunal, and had to make decisions touching on these things. But there's been a great centralisation of planning authority in state governments. City of Fremantle now rarely get anything that you'd call a controversial or big planning application. They go straight to a JDAP, a Joint Development Assessment Panel. And if they're big enough, they go straight to the State Planning Commission, which can take into account myriad factors, including the economic and the social, not just the planning and the environmental or the heritage. So there's a sense that cities of Fremantle, local government authorities, really are not just minor players, but not all that influential in the process, which does raise a question, I suppose, with a new planning scheme. To what extent can it carry forth a new regulatory age for heritage in Fremantle?
Well, I think that's articulated well, but therein lies both the threat and the opportunity. It's a national and international process that central government has sought to regularise and standardise provisions that relate to heritage places. So standard instruments are de rigueur right around the country. It still falls typically to local government agencies to prepare the heritage schedules and to identify to which these might apply and to prepare local policies or guidelines. So recognising that the trend is indeed towards centralised decision making with things like planning commissions or panels, what becomes important is that the rules and the intent of the controls are clear. That helps the property owner, it helps the community, it helps the developer, and it helps the consent authority. So while I absolutely acknowledge that there has been over time a distancing between, if you like, ground roots support and local authorities versus central decision making, the advent of new planning instruments or legislation provides an opportunity to say, look, let's have a reset. What could we be doing that's different?
So coming to Fremantle, you're going to be talking about this here, and no doubt there'll be some follow-up. What's your first impressions? What sort of things need to be done? Are there some sort of regulatory magic puddings here?
Well, look, let me begin by saying I've been invited to share some comments and suggestions. So I'm not coming having done a major review and making well-formed recommendations. But the first thing that strikes one about Fremantle, and particularly the West End, is how intact it is. And yes, of course, it reflects this early convict settlement, and you have important remnants, including the roundhouse and the warders' cottages and the prison itself. But overwhelmingly, as you say, there is this boomtown, gold rush funded, later Federation period of urban architecture with the whole port history. And the overwhelming impression is it's extraordinarily intact. And it's obviously been well-maintained and been protected, you know, from large-scale intervention and development that you see in similar contexts all around the world. So it's remarkable in that regard. And to my eye and to my experience, that's one of the things that makes it special. It retains a very high degree of integrity and authenticity. But the two observations I'd make are that's incrementally changing, and it's changing in quite a sophisticated way, in that there are a mixture particularly in the West End, of sympathetic infill developments, and to my mind that's very good. It's to be encouraged. Mm-hmm. But also some incremental changes where there are additions, particularly to make buildings higher, with or without setbacks. And this is having the effect, to my eye, of changing the urban morphology. Interestingly here, as you look at them, the majority of these projects feature terrific, clever architecture, but I guess the thing that I would contribute to that consideration is, if we did that to all of the buildings over the next 50 years, is that what we would want to end up with in terms of an authentic, historic, gold rush era port town? Because I don't think it is, and I think now is a really good time to stop and think, what's the end game, so that there isn't this tyranny of individual development approvals that add up in total to something that you would never have done as one project.
It's a beautiful way to raise the issue, to put it that way. Mm. If you've been on the planet for more than 50 years, and even if you're just a little bit less of that, you can imagine the time frame. And could you imagine Fremantle being something different? Could you take a photograph looking out the window here, you and I are taking in at the moment, over the West End, and suddenly imagine that all of the buildings were in fact three stories higher, or two-thirds of them, or half of them even. And you'd say, well, hang on. I was in Avignon in the south of France not long ago. It's not the only wonderful historic centre in towns and villages around France, but you really have tourists going there to see just that, don't you? They don't go there to see something else.
You do, and what they want to see is the real and the authentic. But let me also say that there are highly significant areas in Europe that are evolving and changing in ways that are actually now recognised, you know, with hindsight, as not what we would have done. And a simple example of that would be the roofscape of Vienna, where controls have been changed that allow rooftop conversions, where you get a story and a half of accommodation in what used to be the roofscape, new mansard forms, new modern architecture. And when you look at it on one building, you say, hey, that's quite clever. But when you look at it in terms of the citywide streetscape, it's actually changed what was intact Baroque to something else. And I guess that's the question I would ask here. I'm not in any way telling anyone what they should or shouldn't do. I'm just observing that there seems to be a sort of point in time where some clever individual projects have been approved. And I think now's a good time in the context of a new planning scheme to say, what's the long-term game?
In the in the 70s, these same sorts of issues were coming up big everywhere. New York City, Toronto, spilling over into Sydney, Melbourne.
Absolutely.
Even here. And we came up with the concept of transferring development rights.
Yep.
So you could go high, but you kept what was there.
Yep.
In one way and the other, everything survived that. But it strikes me Fremantle is a little different. But at the same time, you can't have all these old buildings just as museum pieces, can you?
Oh, no. And I'm not, I mean, I'm certainly not advocating that. Just dealing with the whole notion of transferable floor space or air rights. Look, in various places in the world, including Sydney, that has proved to be a good way to capture the value that's created by new development and allow a mechanism of sharing it with those who don't get those new development benefits because they're providing a different public good in the form of an intact historic building. You know, and that's one of the big challenges with cultural heritage conservation in urban contexts, that intact historic buildings as part of a streetscape or part of a town are a public good, and yet the cost of looking after them is borne by the individual owner, not by the community who enjoys their presence as part of the town. So what does that mean? Well, it probably means in the context, again, of a new planning scheme and the pressures that are happening all around Australia from housing crisis or need for increased residential densities, that there needs to be, firstly, some hard decisions about upzoning. And in my view, I mean, as council's already kind of looking to do, having that directed towards the east and the north of the city makes perfect sense. But indeed, there's then an opportunity to say, well, if there's upzoning and value creation there, what does that mean in terms of the... If that's the yin, what's the yang for the core of the historic centre? And what can we do there to make sure that in 50 or 100 years' time, it's as we would like it to be?
And in that sense, hasn't crumbled. I mean, what are the options for getting imaginative reuse of, let's just call them old buildings, so that they survive and yet you still have a reasonably quarantined West End?
Well, I mean, that's one of the things that I find striking and lovely about the West End of Fremantle is that the occupation of, I don't know, around 40% of the historic buildings by the University of Notre Dame has had, you know, one very beneficial effect, that those buildings are occupied, they're used. I mean, look, it's clear when you look at them that there's a mixture of physical conservation problems, but my overall perception is that the university has done a great service to the city by coming in and providing them with ongoing use and therefore a basis to be cared for. The question I'd raise in relation to the university presence in the town, and I do find myself thinking, you know, in terms of that history, convictism or gold rushes or boom time or Federation, port, are we now, you know, in the middle of the university phase of the city? They do tend to turn their backs on the streets, the buildings that have university tenants. And is there an opportunity over time to collaborate, you know, collaboration between the city and the university, which could provide for more activation? I mean, my overwhelming impression in terms of the street, and I'm here not in term time, is that there are some major axes like High Street that are quite active and buzzy, and therefore you have people. But some of the side streets, there's a real opportunity there to make them more people oriented. But to do that, you need to have uses at ground level that are street facing, not inwardly facing.
Well, I think we're certainly in very interesting times. A Churchill report has just been produced by Sarah Booth, who's just come back from Western Europe particularly, trying to work out how you can incentivise, if not penalise, landowners and landlords who don't activate their shop fronts and the like.
Yeah, I think that's very tricky, and my strong view would be it's an issue of collaboration and incentives, not regulation. But I'd also say that it needs to be a sort of strategic partnership. And again, the moment of a new planning scheme where there may be opportunities to provide incentives is a good time to do that.
And of course, you're going to need state government central approval to amend your planning scheme.
Absolutely. And I mean, one of the things that I'm very pleased about is the opportunity I've had during this visit to interact with Darren Foster, the chair of the Heritage Council, and understand the council's, you know, overarching advisory role in the planning system. And I'm beginning to turn my mind to how on earth to connect. You've got this state listed West End precinct, you've got a world and national listed prison precinct. There's an interesting bit in between those two, which is, you know, part of the original convict grant. And I think in some ways that's a bit of a no man's land, and there's an opportunity there, you know, possibly for council, possibly for the state government to lead in terms of saying, well, actually, historically, this is a really important part of the prison estate, and functionally in urban conservation terms, it's also now part of this historic streetscape. Yet at the moment, it's a bit disconnected.
It is disconnected. I agree with you. Others may not, but absolutely it is. So what are the sort of, not procedural steps in a regulatory sense, but the sort of phases that you think people in Fremantle need to go through to get this 50-year vision that then can be reflected, or in cautionary principles at least, in a planning scheme or other regulatory documents or statements?
Well, look, I wouldn't be so bold based on, you know, I mean, I've spent a little bit of time looking at the documents, meeting the people visiting the site. I wouldn't be so bold as to tell either council or the society or the community what to do. But I think best practice models involve consultation and collaboration, and I think the council is clearly committed to that. What I would particularly add, I guess, as a result of this visit, would be to say, firstly, in a context where around the country and Western Australia, Perth, Fremantle are no different, there is an enormous need to provide opportunities for more new development to address housing needs. Be bold. So don't try and spread the love everywhere. Look at what parts of the city are suitable for very substantial upzoning, and thereby create opportunities by releasing pressure elsewhere. And the West End is an easy place to say, well, clearly that is not somewhere to be going after new increased residential densities. Then secondly, I'd say, notwithstanding the need for consent authorities always to address the application that's in front of them and is it lawful, should it be approved, I would be asking that question about where do we want this city to be in 50 or 100 years, because my observation would be we probably don't want to keep replicating the roof additions that are happening to some of the historic buildings around the West End, not to say none, but they seem to be on the precipice of setting a precedent, which might not be what's best. The street activation we've talked about, and I think that's a carrot, not a stick. And the question of how the prison, you know, it's a World Heritage property that gets a couple of 100,000 visitors a year, but it's actually not that well connected to the rest of the historic part of the city. And therein, I think, lies an opportunity, which is more of a master planning exercise and a collaboration between state government, local government, and some of the commercial interests in the vicinity.
Well, Richard McKay, it's been really interesting talking to you. You're always, when you come from the eastern side of the country, at risk of being identified by the locals as a wise man from the east, which can sort of deaden your messages immediately, but I'm sure you know all about that, and people are going to be very interested to hear what you have to say. So good luck with all of your consultations, all of the engagements that you're involved in, and look forward to hearing more from you. Thanks for joining me today.
No, thank you, Michael. It's been lovely chatting, and I've really enjoyed the very warm welcome that I've had, so thank you.